you're wrong with Ian and Bobby, you're wrong.
So what do your notes say? What's the first thing we should do?
Talk about the royal wedding.
Did you see that dress? Man.
Why do we do this? Why is the royal wedding a thing? Didn't we go to war with Britain to get our independence so we wouldn't have to deal with this shit anymore?
Wow, Bobby, what a hot take on the royal wedding. You're so interesting.
I am. I'm very interesting. There are no hot takes on the royal wedding, because every take is a take that someone has and has been very vocal about. But seriously, what the fuck? Why does Britain still have a royal family? It's insane.
I think it's fun for some people. It's not my thing, but I know
yeah,
people
I'm sure
that
it's it's fun for all the impoverished people in Britain who are watching all of this opulence and going like, it'd be really cool if we could just sell this castle and like...
I think that's an accurate statement to make about that world, but I don't think that's what impoverished people are thinking. I think there's something weirdly inspirational about... I mean, I think that if you, like, looked at the numbers, lower-class people would probably be more... I mean, this is totally an assumption, but I think lower-class people would be more likely to tune in. I don't think that's something that, like, the rich in America, at least, are interested in at all.
They can't tune in, Ian, because they don't have TVs. But they do have iPhones. That's what Jason Chaffetz
and lots of avocados.
Ian, I went to Mother's Day brunch last week.
Uh-huh.
With my mom.
That's good that you went with her. It would have been weird otherwise.
Yeah, I did. I went with my mom. I was thinking about not inviting her, yeah. But you know, at the end of the day, I went with her. And we went to this place. It was really good. It was pretty hipstery, and they had a really delicious dish that was, well, it had strawberries on it.
What is happening right now?
No. It had strawberries and a balsamic reduction, and it was with avocado on top of toast. And I hated myself a little bit.
I hate you right now a little bit.
And I ordered $12 avocado toast for brunch.
Yeah. Well, did you feel good about yourself now?
I mean, it was good. It was really good. So, yeah, I felt pretty good.
You know, who eats avocado toast? Like... We live in this world. Do you think the people, like, watching you who are impoverished onto the street, like, eating avocado toast, do you think that's fun for them? They're probably like,
oh, yeah.
Oh, you could just sell this avocado toast and buy
me
a TV so I can watch the royal wedding.
It's fun for me.
So, Bobby, what have you been up to this week? Do you need a second to check your notes?
No. I have my notes right here. So, anyway, Hyrule Warriors just came out on the Switch, and I stayed up late last night playing Hyrule Warriors, and I'm pretty excited about that.
So we're back to the Zelda podcast again, are we?
Yeah. But I mean, Hyrule Warriors doesn't count, because it takes like...
Because Link's not in it.
Link is the main character in it.
Oh, weird.
You play as Link.
What's the game called again?
Legend of Zelda Hyrule Warriors.
Okay, so, but you're saying it's not a Zelda game.
No, because it doesn't have any puzzles. You just pick any of the characters in the Zelda universe... Mm-hmm. And you fight thousands and thousands of enemies at a time, and you just feel very overpowered and awesome, and it's very mindless and hack and slashy, and it's wonderful.
That sounds kind of cool.
It's pretty cool.
I beat God of War, and that game is amazing.
Yeah, I thought you talked about that last time.
Oh, did I talk? Okay, sorry.
Yeah, it's like the Logan of the God of War franchise.
I knew I talked about it last time. I didn't know if I had beaten it yet.
Do you really beat it, or do you... Do you come to the end of your journey?
Both. Also, I just recently, I hung out with my family a bunch last weekend too for Mother's Day, and my mom and I watched one of my favorite movies, which is a new movie for me, Hunt for the Wilder People.
Oh,
and,
that's so good.
That movie and God of War have literally the exact same plot, and you're like the only person I know who would appreciate that, so you need to hurry up and play that game.
See, if you had pitched God of War as like the Hunt of the Wilder People of the God of War series.
Yeah.
I think I would have been confused.
What else? I haven't been up to much this week. I'm still playing a lot of Monster Hunter and watching a lot of West Wing.
Mm-hmm. Did you beat West Wing yet?
Dude, I beat West Wing years ago. You know, I've never finished that show.
Really?
Yeah, Aaron Sorkin left after the first four seasons, and I've always tried to watch the last three, and it feels a lot like when I try to watch season four of Community. It just... There's something heartbreaking about it after he leaves. It doesn't feel the same. So.
There's only seven seasons of that show?
Yeah. Wow. I think so.
But they're like 24 episode seasons?
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. It's a big show. What else have I been up to? Yeah, not much. I rewatched the Netflix Punisher show recently, kind of in I've been thinking a lot this week about how I'm going to frame the pick that I made for today, which is the Punisher comic book.
Well, you kill them with an icicle. That way the evidence melts away and it's easy to frame anyone.
But I think in light of the world we live in and the shooting yesterday, which was obviously insane and all that, I wanted to think a lot about why I feel okay picking the Punisher. So I'm going to talk about that in a little bit. But other than that, I haven't been up to much new stuff. Have you been doing anything other than playing Hyrule?
Yeah, I watched a Netflix documentary kind of in like one day called Evil Genius. Have you heard of it?
No. Oh, I have heard of it, but just recently. I don't know what it's about, though.
It's a documentary series. It's about the, do you remember the pizza bomber? Is that what they called it? There was this bank heist. This guy goes into a bank with a bomb strapped around his neck and hands them a note saying, you know, they have to rob the bank or else the bomb around his neck will explode.
Right.
The police officers catch up to this guy.
Oh, yes. They based the movie on this, right?
Which movie?
They made a movie about it. With Aziz Ansari and 30 Minutes or Less. The two guys strap a bomb to them and force them to rob banks, right? He's a pizza delivery guy?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, it appears to be a similar
It's the guy who directed Zombieland made the movie. I forget. I forget who else is in it. There's, I think, Danny McBride and
Nick Swartzen. And some
other... Yeah, that's right.
Michael Pena.
Michael Pena. Is Michael Cera maybe in that movie? Or somebody else related to Superbad? I feel like...
No.
It doesn't matter. Anyway. Yeah, music, sorry. I totally derailed
by,
you.
By Ludwig Göransson, who did music for Community and Black Panther. So... That's interesting.
So you're just reading Wikipedia.
I am. Do you want to know who did the cinematography?
So tell me your story, because I totally derailed you.
So yeah, the cops catch up to this guy, cut his shirt open, see that he has a bomb, and he's, you know, this guy's calm, and he's just like, someone needs to go. I'm collecting these clues, and these clues are supposed to give me instructions on how to take this bomb off. And so that's fine, but someone really needs to go to the next location and get the next clue so I can figure out how to get this bomb off.
Right.
And they don't, and the bomb is real and goes off and kills this guy.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
I did not know that.
Yeah. So it's not a funny story. It's just insane.
No, not at all.
And so it's kind of about, you know, this one woman kind of got pegged with being the mastermind behind the crime. And it's kind of about the planning that might have gone into it, or people who got immunity in the process that might have had a bigger role to play in it, or, you know, whether or not.
So it's a true crime doc just about this very bizarre crime.
Yeah, and it's that first episode is really disturbing, because I mean, it's well edited together, but it's just, I think, because I don't remember this crime at all, and right. So like watching the build up to, you know, this guy getting killed, I was just like, well, there's no way that's a real bomb and that's going to go off, right? You know, because it just defies what our expectations of what's possible in the universe are,
right.
You know?
Right. Yes. No, agreed. That's insane.
Yeah. So that was.
Well, I've heard a lot of hype about it recently. I didn't know what it was about at all, but I heard the title and people saying it was good. So
yeah, I think that maybe it's like narratively, it's not as narratively focused as some of the other Netflix documentaries, but the story is just so crazy. And
right.
I think, you know, it, the note it kind of ends on, if it does, like, actually, because it claims to bring something new to this trial or to the conclusion of the case that people didn't know. If that is indeed accurate, then that's cool that this doc got that out. But, yeah, I would recommend it. It's not as good. It's not as well made as some of the other Netflix docs, but it's still good.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
Sorry, I don't have much to. I literally am doing the exact same stuff I was.
I mean, we could keep talking.
I can
about
tell you.
High Warriors,
I can tell
you
about the
you
cool
want.
New. I can tell you about the cool new sword I got in Monster Hunter.
What is it?
I mean, I killed an Angerath, and I got a sword that lights other monsters on fire. I'm pretty excited about it. It happened at 1 a.m. last night, so.
You know what I found out last night, Ian?
What's that?
After we did our top five video games last week, and I told you that one of my favorite games is Link's Awakening. Uh-huh. Marin from Link's Awakening is an unlockable character in Hyrule Warriors, and so that's pretty exciting for me.
I fear that people are not clear on how self-aware we are, that we're pathetic people, that these are the things that we share about in our lives.
We both have a firm understanding that Ian's kind of a pathetic person.
I do have most of my friends, I would say you're the one exception to this. Most of my friends assume that all of my other friends are as nerdy as I am and give me a lot of crap about it. And when I'm like, yeah, I know, they're like, well, somebody has to keep you grounded. I'm like, no, every friend I have, quote unquote, keeps me grounded. Like, I don't need you all to point out how ridiculous I am all the time.
I mean, you're nerdiness and your your kind of like your niche of pop culture obsession has been fairly validated throughout your life to the point where you're just teaching it now for a
that
living,
is
right?
True, that is true. I am kind of living in the golden age of being the alpha consumer that I grew up to be.
It's not like no one ever like rapped you on the back of your hand and told you to stop reading comic books, you know.
Maybe they definitely did. Yeah, that definitely happened.
But your story is victorious. You're like, well, I'll show you.
So, Bobby, speaking of victorious.
Yeah, speaking of victorious what?
Oh, okay. What do your notes say about your pick for this week, Bobby?
So,
this is unusable. This is an unusable podcast. We need to start over. Bobby accidentally deleted his notes about 3 minutes before starting the show today, is what I am trying to point out.
Oh, Jesus, we're a mess. Look at, we're not even at the part where my notes would derail, you know, my lack of notes would derail the podcast, but just knowledge of the fact that I don't have notes is derailing our podcast.
No, I'm trying to derail it because I think it's funny. Let's get into your pick for the week.
Experience wonder. Experience laughter and sound. Experience love. Experience lust. Experience pain. Experience Bobby.
Okay, so my pick for the week is a 12-issue run on The Vision. The Vision is the synthezoid magical robot member of the Avengers. He's been in the movies lately, played by Paul Bettany. And
who somehow in the movies now just has the ability to look human. That's like something they decided to do.
Yeah, in that last movie. It's because you have to feel, I think in this last movie, you have to feel emotional weight behind the Vision. And they just, I don't think they trusted the makeup completely. And so
I've actually never been a huge fan of the Vision makeup for the movies. There's something slightly off about it. It just feels very like TV special effects makeup to me. I don't know exactly what it is.
I think you're nuts. I think the Vision makeup has always looked cool.
I don't know. I don't like it.
There's something that looks really unsettling and otherworldly, but in a good way, I think.
You know what it is for me? I think that it's clear that he's wearing like a plastic thing around his head, and then he does just have a human face. Like the makeup doesn't make him look artificial enough in the face region, and so it kind of like ruins the illusion for me a little bit.
I think he looks robot and weird, except he's got Paul Bettany's eyes, but that's kind of a cool choice. I don't know.
Interesting. Okay.
He does not have eyes in this comic book, and nor do any of the members of his family.
Yeah, so let's talk about the premise, because I think if anybody is remotely in the world of comic books, they've probably at least seen the cover of the first issue of this, and that is all I was familiar with before I started reading it this last week and a half. So,
and the basic,
what is this book about?
The basic premise is the Vision wanting to lead a normal human life creates a family for himself. He creates a wife, Virginia, and two twin kids, Viv and Vin, and settles into the suburbs of Arlington, Virginia. And yeah, the first cover is this family of four, very unsettlingly smiling while kind of phasing out of their front door, because the Visions don't have to use doors or walls, they can phase through them.
So the first thing I will take minor issue with in what you just said, if you don't mind, is I feel like that cover looks very silly and fun and light. I don't think it looks disconcerting. I think it only looks disconcerting after you have read the series.
Yes, I agree.
Okay.
And I think the premise sounds funny. It sounds like a comedy of errors is about to ensue as these robots try to understand human life and are not doing a great job at kind of
right.
Conforming to their neighborhood and conforming to the norms of human life. And I mean, in a way, it is sort of a comedy of errors, but the sure. comic itself, what caught me off guard, my friend Jung recommended this comic to me. He was really,
hi Jung,
he doesn't listen. But okay. he was really dead set on
fuck you, John.
Getting me to read two Marvel comics. One of them was Vision and one of them was Hawkeye by Matt Fraction. Yeah.
Which is fantastic as well.
And they're very different, but they're similar in that it kind of concerns what the Avengers do on their off days, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. They're both very small, quiet stories in a lot of ways.
Yeah, it's not about saving the world. It's kind of about saving their personal lives.
Can I say a little bit about how I came into this?
Please.
And what I liked about it from the start?
Yes.
So I think, because I think while you obviously have read this more than I have, I don't think either of us would argue that I have probably a more substantial knowledge of the context of this character in Marvel Comics in general, I mean.
Rude, but so go on.
I've always liked the Vision. Vision was originally created by Ultron in the comics, who is a Avengers supervillain to destroy the Avengers. And then he, of course, gains sentience and becomes a good guy because that's what happens in comics. So he has this very interesting connection to like supervillainy, which the second generation of Avengers in the comics all had that. The second generation Avengers were Quicksilver and Scarlet Witch, who were the children of Magneto and previously terrorists. There was Hawkeye, who was an ex-con, and then there was Vision. So this marks a little bit of a change, a little bit of a move towards what people who watch Marvel movies are more familiar with, which is kind of the moral ambiguity of some of these characters. One of the things I like about this book is you don't need any of the backstory that I'm going to go into right now to appreciate or understand these characters. It walks you through it pretty well, but the backstory helps a lot and is really fun. So in the comics, Vision eventually falls in love with Scarlet Witch. They get married, and Scarlet Witch has powers that in the comics become very increasingly
unstable
and more powerful. Her reality altering abilities wreak havoc on her sense of reality. And so she starts to basically go crazy. And because she and Vision can't have children together, she creates two children of her own. And eventually, you know, people like show her that she's having a mental breakdown and is like altering reality in ways that are unsafe. And they, the children go away. The children disappear.
Was this House of M?
This is all before House of M.
Okay.
This is like old school stuff. So then because of that, House of M happens, which is Scarlet Witch has a mental breakdown and alters the world completely. She destroys the Avengers. This is all done kind of unconsciously. She's having like a breakdown and is essentially has godlike power. She kills Vision. She destroys the Avengers, all this stuff. And Vision's a robot, so he eventually comes back. We find out very early on, it's hinted from the beginning that all of the like Ultron and Vision and all of these synthetic robots in the Marvel comics are based on the brain waves of characters that already exist. So Ultron created a wife for himself, and that's that's based on the brainwaves of the Wasp, because Ultron was created by Hank Pym, and Hank Pym loved the Wasp, right? So there's all this kind of stuff. We find out very quickly that Vision has created Virginia using the brainwaves of Scarlet Witch, who we know was at one time the love of Vision's life, and is also a very unstable person emotionally. All of that kind of leads into this very, very, very twisted suburban family drama that just knocked me out of my socks. It feels like this book feels kind of like if Mad Men was about a family of people with very high functioning autism, because it's dealing with the suburban nuclear family issues of white picket fence American dream. With these characters who talk like robots.
Right.
And so they are emotional. They have emotions, but they clinically explain everything that they're going through in a way that is very, very compelling to read and very heartbreaking. This book is very, very sad.
It's a very sad book.
I liked from the start that Virginia is both the name of the new home he has created for himself and the name of his wife, because both of those things very slowly decay and fall apart. I mean, this is a book about a man who creates a wife and children for himself. So there's obviously patriarchal issues and concerns that immediately come up when you hear that. I think this book does a very, very good job of showing clearly how these are independent people from him, how they have their own hopes and dreams, and how they're not necessarily going to be the same hopes and dreams that he has.
I would say, I think if there's a protagonist of this series, it's Virginia. I think we get Virginia's point of view more than we do Vision's. I was reading a write-up. I forget. I would credit them. I forget who it was. And they kind of
explained
it away.
By the way, everybody who likes good writing should read this. Like, everything I just went into is going to make this sound really comic booky and silly. That's not necessary to your understanding of the comic. And it's very, very well written. People should read this even if they have no interest in Marvel.
It's pretty self-contained in that it's about a family of robots trying to learn how to be human, you know?
Yes.
And trying to discover their own personal worth in the world that they inhabit. I'm sorry, I cut you off. What'd you say?
No. I started to cut you off, actually. I was going to say there were times where I wish it was a little more self-contained than it was. Because I absorb media by while I'm enjoying it, thinking about who I would tell to watch this or read this. And there were times where I was thinking like, oh, this person would like this, this person would like this. And then I would get to, you know, the history of Wonder Man and Grim Reaper and be like, oh, they're not going to understand what's happening here. And I think it does walk people through that. But I think there are moments where people who are not versed or literate in comic book, Marvel comic history are going to have to kind of trudge through some stuff. And you know, does that make sense?
Yeah, but I think also, because I don't know, I literally knew nothing about Grim Reaper, and I barely know anything about Wonder Man.
Right.
And I mean, you have to understand that there is a group called the Avengers that Vision is
That's
a part
true.
Of. You need to understand That's... that superheroes exist in this world. Mm-hmm. But like, you know, in the first issue, this villain called Grim Reaper shows up. You literally don't need to know anything about him other than the fact that he is, you know, a
Crazy.
Villain. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wonder Man, like, I feel like everything you need to know about him is in his name as far as like his role in the story, you know, and right. you do get to, it crosses one of the characters from Runaways plays a significant part in this story. And, I think pretty efficiently as he's being introduced into the story, his deal is being introduced.
Yes. They handle his backstory because, I would say he's the only character you actually have to know his backstory because it relates to who he is in relation to the Vision family Vision. Because he's another child of Ultron. So he's essentially their
Vision's brother.
Vision's brother. Yeah.
Which is kind of interesting.
Which is interesting. So I agree. I like that. Although I will say as a fan of Victor, who is one of the Runaways is one of my favorite comics. And I would say that Victor is maybe my favorite character from those comics. I was unhappy with how they handled him and what they did to him. Although I do understand that, you know, different creators take up different tools in a Marvel sandbox and use them differently. So I'm fine with that. But it was a little heartbreaking for me to see a character I loved so much essentially turned into a drug addict. Why don't I feel like we're talking about
ahead.
Yeah, I feel like we're talking about things that are cool about it, but we haven't even described the basic concept yet.
I want to say
yeah.
This I think this summarizes the dynamic and kind of the struggle of the comics. Mm-hmm. Again, I read a write up somewhere. I would credit if I remember who had written it, but they summarized kind of what Vision does to kick off this story as he's basically created a dollhouse and has placed a bunch of sentient dolls in the dollhouse and just trusts that they're going to be what he assumes they're going to be when he leaves for the day and goes to work. And
yes.
What we really see is his wife and his children struggling to come to grips with the meaning of their own lives, if that makes any
because
sense.
Because they're all essentially a week old and he is using them to feel normal.
Right.
Right? Like what he has done is fairly selfish. If we're going to think of them as real people. And he doesn't seem to be super concerned with the ramifications of that they're experiencing.
Right.
Although I don't think he's like an, I don't think he's an asshole or anything. I think he's unaware.
I think he takes for granted their own emotional existence, you know?
Yes, yes.
That they each have
like,
their
like,
own.
I mean, there's a part towards the end where you flash back to him first having created Virginia, and he essentially, when she wakes up, explains to her who she is and then asks if she would like to be his wife. And like, that's I mean, as above board as you can be, I suppose, but also that's a bizarre question to put to somebody who has existed for 13 minutes. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, it's, so there's a lot of stuff like that. I think, I mean, I guess the inciting incident would be that this guy attacks their family right at the beginning. Mm-hmm. Virginia protects them and accidentally kills him and then doesn't tell Vision about it. She buries the body and tries to go back about her normal life. And so the wife is going through this journey that metaphorically works really well, where she is living this kind of ghost-like existence as a suburban wife, where she has this dark secret that she can't share with anybody.
They literally have bodies buried in their backyard.
Yes. I also really enjoyed how kind of there's this unspoken but very clear sense that the Avengers don't know what to do with this.
Mm-hmm.
Because in the chronology of the comics, you know, he was married to this woman. They had children together. They found out the children weren't real. She killed him. He came back. She is in a relationship with somebody new now. And then he creates this family for himself. And it's meant to feel very creepy. I think the fact that you mentioned they don't have eyes, I think that is important.
Mm-hmm.
The kids especially, you know, a smile with just blank empty eyes feels very creepy in the context. And it does feel the whole time like you know he's doing something wrong. And he even maybe knows he's doing something wrong. And it's not morally wrong in a way that we can quantify. It just feels icky.
Yeah. And there's a, well, I want to talk about the narrator in a second, but
yeah.
There is a sense of dread, of inevitability, kind
yes.
of, in this comic.
I think that's why I partially compared it to Mad Men.
And I think the fact that the Vision and the Avengers seem to be at this unspoken standoff with each other, where
yeah.
the Avengers are quite frankly afraid of Vision, but they
yes.
so they don't want to step on Vision's toes because they know that Vision is powerful and they don't want to like
right.
Step over their own moral boundaries. And
yeah.
the fact that Vision knows that he has this very fragile existence that he's built, and that if he steps out of line, the Avengers will come down on him.
Right.
There's this just this very tense dynamic between the two of them, and
right.
you there just doesn't seem to be a solvable good outcome out of it, except for his family being the perfect family, which we know they're not going to be, you know.
Right. Right. And there is this, I mean, the book does a very good job of continually reminding us why he was originally created and that he is Ultron's son, essentially, because obviously he spent, you know, the last 30 years of comics rejecting that programming. However, here he is creating a family that has a very, very tenuous grasp on the sanctity of life. And that thought keeps coming back to us, that Vision was created to destroy humanity. And here he is trying to either be part of humanity or copy humanity and replace it. And the fact that these other people are, you know, there's these moments where the other characters, very rightfully so in terms of the emotional stakes they're dealing with, enact violence on human beings. And it, even though we know that it's, they're going through something, it's still really creepy. We're still a little afraid of all of them.
Mm-hmm.
There's a part in this book where they accidentally kill their neighbor's dog. And then they use the dog's brainwaves to create themselves a robot dog. Like they do have a very, they're something off.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't, they're not just persecuted. And persecution, especially suburban persecution, is a huge part of this. It's a really fun kind of B story where the high school has recently changed its mascot from the Redskins to the Warriors or something like that. And of course, the Vision and his family all have literal red skin.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this great line about, how, you know, humanity is always trying to do better, but the echoes of the past stick around.
Yeah.
Because the high school paintings have all changed this new mascot, but all the equipment still has the Redskins logo.
Yeah. And there's a great frame of Vision holding up a football with a racist depiction of a Native American
yes.
with red skin, and he's holding
yes.
it up right next to his own face, and Vision isn't necessarily making that comparison, but it's just so very obvious to anyone reading it.
Yes.
What's interesting, so the very first scene of this comic, there's an omniscient narrator that kind of,
by the way, are we avoiding spoilers?
I think we should.
I think the inciting incident stuff that we talked about isn't really a spoiler. That all happens in like the first
No,
issue
and I
two,
think we
but,
could talk vaguely
yeah.
about things that happen later, but I don't think we should spoil the whole thing. I don't think it's necessary.
I agree, because I think people should really read this. It's great. Did you say it was by Tom King?
Tom King, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
And so Tom King writes this omniscient narrator in, I think, it kind of play, if I'm reading it correctly, it plays with who that narrator is at different times also.
Yes, yes.
But
there's times where it feels like Vision is talking about himself in third person, and then there's times where it clearly feels like an outside observer,
and there are other times when the narrator will blend into what someone else is saying, you know.
Yes, and that's not sloppy writing. It's done for a reason. Revealed by the end. Yeah.
And so we see these, their neighbors, who are this nervous kind of older couple, come to the Vision's house with cookies.
Yes.
Which is kind of adorable. But they, yes. and since Vision is good, you know, we like Vision going into this. He's a hero. When they start to say things that are sort of racist or sort of unfair toward the Visions, I think we as the reader are supposed to get a little bit defensive of the Visions.
Sure, sure.
And immediately as they're leaving, the narrator informs us that by the end of the story, one of the Visions will burn their house down and that they will die in the flames. And it talks about like their final thoughts. And I think that sets that sets the tone for the rest of the series. It's just,
this is all in the first like four pages. Yeah,
spoilers. This is literally the first scene. You know, you have this narrator constantly commenting on the goings on and on the future of all of these characters. Viv, who I think is just a really great, interesting character. Vision's daughter.
Yes.
You know, she says something at one point, and the narrator mentions, you know, that Viv, she experiences something that is very emotionally profound to her. And since she's a robot, she can continually just play it over and over and over again in her mind.
Yes.
And the narrator mentions, you know, though Viv's life was shorter than, you know, she might have, she would constantly replay this memory over and over to herself, and she never told anyone about it. And that's just flattening, you know, because you are really invested in this, the life of the 16-year-old robot girl, and to find out that her life will not be very long is really sad, you know, as she's experiencing this really profound human thing that, you know, you can relate to, you know.
I think for me, the single best moment of the entire series that kind of encapsulates the whole series is there's this moment where I believe they're alone. It's just the four of them. They go out to dinner, and you see a scene. There's this one panel where the waiter comes over and says, "Are you sure you don't want me to bring any of the food you've ordered?" And the Vision says, no, just wait about 45 minutes and then bring us the check. So they went to a restaurant, ordered food, told the waiter not to bring it because they don't eat, sat there for 45 minutes, and then paid the check and left to feel human.
Yeah.
Which is amazing. That's incredibly sad and poignant and like,
well, it's,
I don't
they,
know.
They go
it's
out.
Great.
That scene, they go out because they have company. Victor.
That's right.
His quote unquote brother is with them, who also doesn't eat. And so it's like a special occasion, and they all go out to celebrate, but they're all just sitting around this empty table talking in public.
It's brilliant.
Yeah.
It's brilliant. I am, first off, I am a big Shakespeare fan, and the son goes through this journey in the book of, I think he's the one who is experiencing most closely the, like, what does it all mean to be a robot thing. Mm-hmm. The rest of them are trying to be normal in different ways, but he's very specifically focusing on that, on his differences and how other people see his differences. He has this moment where he, you know, gets violent with a student at school, and then everyone's afraid of him, and he gets very, very obsessed with the Merchant of Venice, the Shylock from the Merchant of Venice.
Yes.
For those of you who don't know, Shylock is a very anti-Semitic character who is a Jewish lender who is kind of, you know, made into a villain by the hatred of him from as a Jew from the people around him. Because that book is, or that play is extremely complicated. Shylock is a horrible person. He is. However, he has been made that way by the world he lives in. And the fact that we know the potential for villainy in these characters' programming, and the fact that the son is obsessed with this character is very, very complex. And I like that a lot. It's not often you see Shakespeare in a Marvel comic, much less Shakespeare that you don't have to already be familiar with to enjoy. So,
and Shakespeare layered on top of several moments throughout the comic.
Yeah, like that becomes kind of his running motif. Yeah.
Yeah.
So is it an invention of this book that vibranium functions as a drug for machines? Because I had never seen that before in a Marvel thing, and that's interesting. I like that. And it's played down. It's very, very subtle the way that is presented. But I enjoyed it.
I enjoy this book, man. I really love this book. It's such a weird, like, sort of...
The art's amazing, by the way. That's something we should talk about. Mm-hmm. The art is incredibly well done. It feels a lot like Hawkeye. I think the artists have a different style. What I mean is...
Very strong
the
lines.
Type of... Very strong lines, but I also mean the colors they use give you a similar cinematic tone and a emotional response to the book. It feels small. There's these giant splash pages. I think there's like three of them where Vision is actually being an Avenger and fighting some giant creature, and it feels so out of place in the comic. It
cartoony and weird
because it does make it feel like, oh, that's his other job, this is his home, you know. And so it's I like that. I like the and the, I liked everything about this
the
book.
Art is
this,
by Gabriel Hernandez Balta.
I'm talking about the positives and negatives because this is a podcast and that's what you do. But yeah. I'm very confident in saying this is one of the best Marvel comics I have read. It's very, very good. It's rare-ish that I would recommend something to people from Marvel that are not already versed or interested in Marvel. Runaways is one of them. This is definitely another.
It's so when you pitch it to people to try to get them to read it when they're not comic fans, it sounds like such a comic booky premise. And I'm not, this is not to degrade the medium at all. It's just, it's not a superhero comic is what I'm trying to say.
Superhero comics, especially mainstream superhero comics, are great and they do a job.
Yeah.
But that job is not emotional gravitas and stakes and payoff because comic books, I mean, here's the thing. In 5 years, this is all going to be retconned away. So this essentially functions as a self-contained story anyway, right? Like Vision is not going to be this Vision in 5 years because somebody else is going to take over the comic and write him differently. And that's okay too. But
it's a bleak.
Because of that, I think in this moment, it's allowed to go places.
Yeah. And I would say that the tone is it's a very bleak, kind of unsettling domestic drama, if anything.
Very bleak. I was more prepared for that because you, when you first read this, kind of texted me at the time and said, holy shit, this book is really dark. But I know when you first read it, you were expecting, because like we said about the cover, kind of feeling very fun and funny, something a lot different in terms of tone.
And it's intensely readable. Like, it's easy to read. Yeah. You get sucked into it for sure. But you don't walk away giggling and going, that was fun. You walk away going like, oh, fuck. You know?
Yes. Agreed.
So I'm glad you liked it.
Oh, I loved it. What kinds of superhero comics do you like? Have you read much else?
Recently, no. I've read what's the most recent thing I've read? I mean, this and Hawkeye, because Jung had me read them, and I liked both of them a lot. I read Runaways recently, because you and Jung both recommended that, and I liked that. That's not exactly recent though. I like Ms. Marvel a lot. I like Kamala Khan.
That's true. Yeah, that's a very, very good one.
I just bought a bunch of Mighty Thor, the run of Jane Foster's Thor. I haven't read it yet.
Okay. I've never read that either. That's cool. I did think it was very funny because I am a few years behind in terms of what is currently happening in the Marvel Universe. I tend to read comics in big bursts all at once and catch up. So it was funny to me to see, you know, some of these shots of the Avengers. I'm like, oh, there's like... there's Falcon as Captain America, and there's female Thor, which I assume is Jane Foster, and there's all these changes in the lineup that, like,
Spider-Man is Miles Morales.
Yeah, exactly. There's all these different changes that I'm unfamiliar with, and it was nice to see the, like, kind of a glimpse at the larger world that they exist in, having changed so much.
And I think all of those are gone now, too, right? I think...
Well, yeah, probably.
Odinson is back to Thor, and Steve Rogers is Captain America again.
Yeah, like I said, stakes don't matter in comic books.
Life goes on.
With that in mind, I wanted to kind of use that as a transition into mine, unless you are...
Nope, let's do it.
better than your thing. I wanted to talk really briefly about kind of a serious thing, because I picked The Punisher, and we are living in an age of very, very, very intense feelings about gun control, and I will say directly on the podcast that I am a advocate for gun control. I think that is extremely important to the society we live in. I'm also a pacifist and would never own a gun myself, and there is a part of me that likes The Punisher, right? And I've been thinking a lot this week about what I think about that, because I am a person who thinks that arguments that say things like, you know, Grand Theft Auto causes mass shootings and things like violent video games cause violent activities in real life, I don't hold to that philosophy. I'm not a fan of the idea or the conversation about censorship in entertainment. However, I also do very strongly believe that all media is political, all art is political, and any kind of story falls into that category. And this is a story about a straight white soldier who goes overseas, kills a bunch of people in war, secretly kind of likes it, comes back, and his perfect white American family is killed, and he goes out in the streets and starts shooting people. That's, I mean, it's essentially the exact same plot as Death Wish, which recently came out and had liberals all a fluster for a good reason. So I think a lot about how much I am able to put this book in the realm of fantasy and just have fun with it, and where that is, and also where that is talking to me in a place that has to do with kind of the machismo that I think is still very alluring to men in this country. I'm babbling a little bit. Do you understand? But do you feel like you get where I'm going with this?
Yes, I do.
So I wanted to talk for a minute about The Punisher, just in general, what your feelings have been about The Punisher in the past. And I thought that would be a good walk into this, because I will say I do like Punisher properties that I think are more problematic than this one. And I eventually may pick some of them for the show. I think the Netflix TV show falls more heavily into that category than this does, because the Netflix show is very grounded, and because of that, it feels much more realistic, and so it is talking about real world issues. I think this comic book is much more hyper real, almost cartoony in some ways, and that takes away some of the sting of that a little bit. But where do you stand on The Punisher, and then what did you think of this book? Were you surprised by how you reacted to it? Was it exactly what you expected? Go ahead and talk for a few minutes. I just asked like an 18-part question.
This is a... So, I don't know a ton about The Punisher. I know I really wanted to watch his first movie when it came out when I was in high school, because I remember the commercial for it had a Stained song playing, and that is exactly the kind of shit I liked when I was in high school.
Really?
Very briefly in high school, man, I was just like, oh man, this is gonna be like,
oh man, I have
hardcore.
I guess I could see that. I just cannot picture high school Bobby listening to Stained, but go ahead.
Which I want to be clear, I don't like Stained now. I look back on that and like facepalm and go like, god damn it, Bobby, what the fuck. I know people have told me really good things about Lexi Alexander's Punisher movie, which I've not seen.
I have not either, and I'm interested in that because I think, from what I've heard, it falls into the same category as this comic book.
We should do like a movie club and watch it and just talk about
it. Yeah.
That'd be cool.
Yeah, that'd be fun.
But I really liked his depiction in Daredevil season 2.
Yeah, me too.
What's his name? Who plays him?
Jon Bernthal, who is great.
Jon Bernthal was really great, and I kind of liked the very, like, I would say he... I mean, though Punisher is always very resolute, as far as I've seen him portrayed, I liked kind of the morally complicated ramifications of him in that show.
Sure, sure.
Which Garth Ennis is not particularly concerned about the moral ramifications.
No, he is definitely not. I think he makes a lot of effort to completely circumvent those as much as possible.
Which is interesting, because the show apes an entire sequence from the Garth Ennis run on The Punisher.
Yes. So if you remember, way back in the day when we first talked about Daredevil, mm-hmm. On the show, I brought up that scene as very strange in the show, because it's the exact same scene used to make it a completely different point, which is very bizarre to me. I because that scene in the comic is very undeniably a pro Punisher scene.
Yeah.
And a very anti Daredevil scene. Garth Ennis very famously has little to no respect for superhero characters. He doesn't think they're interesting. He thinks that they distract us from real world political issues and concerns. And really the only times you see superheroes in his comics, they're used like this. Which is to say, they are shown to be kind of silly men in costume.
Daredevil wanders in and out very quickly in this yes. run, and is a blithering idiot who gives up his only rule very quickly when faced with a decision in this.
Yes.
I told you I read the first two or three issues when I personally was kind of going through a journey dealing with like our political climate and certain things that were hitting pretty close to home with me. Sure. And reading this was very cathartic. I'm using that very cautiously. Like everything you said, because
there is something cathartic about it, and that makes me uncomfortable.
I want to be
something. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah,
go
I
ahead.
Just I want to be very clear. I am very anti-violence. Also, yeah. I feel very similarly about gun control and guns in general.
So that's why I asked this question, because I feel like the Punisher is maybe an unhealthy fantasy.
Yeah. And
but
so,
it's a fun fantasy,
right?
So I don't know what to do with that.
So if you're asking me what my ultimate feelings and my relationship with this 12-issue run was, mm-hmm. I think it would be an I didn't like it with an asterisk. Like
Okay.
I don't know, like, I see what Garth Ennis is doing, and with what he's doing, it's, with a couple of really stupid fat jokes aside, like, I think he's doing it very well.
I think it's very hard to argue that this is not well written.
Right. I just don't.
I think it's extremely well written, but yeah, you don't what?
I think at the end of the day, my question is, why do we need this? If that makes sense.
Well, let's talk about it directly, because I think we're circling again. So what do you want to tell people what Welcome Back, Frank is about, what it felt like for you, what the tone felt like? Because I'm interested to see how you describe it, because it's kind of hard to
if you want to boil it down to its very essential elements, it's about the Punisher very methodically and effectively taking down an organized crime family.
Right.
It's sort of split into a few different points of view. We get a detective who's assigned to the case. We get the Punisher himself. We get the crime family. We get the Punisher's
kind of happy band of misfits
that live in
hideout.
His building.
Yeah.
And that's it, right? Am I missing anyone?
You're missing the vigilante squad.
I'm missing the vigilante squad. We'll get to the vigilante squad in a second. Because I think that's the only thing that Garth Ennis accidentally sort of like steps on. But so we see a lot of people talking about like struggling with their own personal feelings about the Avenger. On the law enforcement side, you know, we see people who really like the Avenger.
You just called him the Avenger.
Did I call him the Avenger?
You called him the Avenger twice.
Oh, wow. You know why? It's because I have a thing open about the Vision, and it says Avengers all over that page.
Okay.
So I won't close that. But he does avenge. He avenges a lot.
He sure does. Here's my thing. I think one of the things that's very interesting about the Punisher, and I think something Garth Ennis understands about the Punisher, is that the Punisher isn't avenging. He's just killing. The Punisher doesn't think that what he's doing will fix anything. I don't believe he does think that. I also don't think the Punisher at this point in the Punisher comics is any more thinking about how he's doing this for his wife and children who died. I think he's doing this because this is just what he does.
He's got
there's something very sad and lonely about that. That's really the only character trait we ever see from him. I would say the Punisher is less of a character in this and more of a plot device.
He's got a very strict moral code about justice, and he just keeps acting on it. He's decided that the Nucci family,
which is the name of the gang that he's fighting,
is a force for evil in this world. and they deserve to be destroyed with no mercy. And so
yes.
he goes through in a series of boss fights and just destroys each son until he works his way up to Manucci, which, I mean, this book is sort of spoiler free in that you know exactly what the Punisher is going to do from the
beginning.
That's
true. That is true. And so there's no real surprises about that. Now, what did you think of the style in which this stuff happens? Because I think Steve Dillon's art, combined with some of the situations the Punisher ends up in, makes this feel sometimes more like South Park than it does like Punisher, in a way that is strange and that I enjoy. That's part of the reason why I gave this to you, is because it feels... I mean, this is a book where the Punisher uses a polar bear as a weapon
mm-hmm.
by punching it in the face and then running away while it kills a bunch of mobsters. I mean, it's a very, very over-the-top, crazy...
There's book. I mean, yes, that does happen.
I mean, that is right after he also kills somebody with a python and drops somebody into a tank of barracudas. It's a very, like, insane.
There's a sequence, an issue earlier where a criminal is going to the morgue to mourn over the loss of a loved one, and the Punisher lays siege to the morgue, uses bodies, like, in the morgue as cover, and, like, the guy he's trying to kill, like, falls back onto his loved one and looks back, like, horrified. But it's not... I want to be clear, this isn't dark and gritty. This is very colorful and cartoony.
Yes. It's dark. It's a black sense of humor, but it's a very gleeful one.
Yes.
I mean, in that same scene, there's a great line that I love where Frank says, "Rule one of fighting in a morgue, don't use the skinny guy for cover," because they're both hiding behind bodies, and... he's able to shoot the other guy because he picked a skinnier corpse to hide behind.
And I mentioned it at the top. I mean, in the first fucking issue, we meet, like, this really colorful cast of characters who live in his building. And, I mean, they're all very silly. One of them is this, like, absurdly obese guy named Mr. Bumpko? Is that his name?
Bumpo.
And the first time we meet him, he's asking Punisher for a hand because he's gotten stuck in his door frame. And Punisher, with his strength, pulls him out without even thinking about it. And he goes, "Thanks." And every time we see him, he's, like, bringing pizzas into his apartment.
Yeah.
And then at one point, he has, like, a massive heart attack. And then he's put on rest and he's bringing a bunch of pizzas back. And then, like, I rolled my eyes at it a lot, but that all eclipses with Punisher killing, like, an unkillable bad guy assassin
yes.
who's sent to kill him by, like, laying on top of Mr. Bumpko, who is tripped and fallen onto our super strong beefy bad guy, and our bad guy is so overpowered by how overweight Mr. Bumpko is that he suffocates, and it's, like, the stupidest cartoony fucking thing I've ever seen in my life. And it wasn't funny, but it also, like, it's very in keeping with it. I bring that up because it's in keeping with the tone of the rest of the comic.
Yes.
It doesn't attempt to deconstruct the character at all. It's just...
No. In fact, it makes fun of people who do.
Yeah.
There's this very, very dark scene early on where our kind of hapless detective... So they basically put this idiot... He's not an idiot. He's a good cop, but he's a very unlucky cop as the task force to hunt this guy down, because, of course, the cops kind of like the Punisher. And he is given a sidekick who is a behavioral specialist who writes this very, very dramatic, dark, gritty, something from, you know, a Frank Miller book about Frank. And, you know, it's immediately dismissed as silly, to the point that that guy hangs himself in the detective's office.
Yeah. Yep.
So you don't like this. Why mm-hmm. do you not like it?
Again, I'm not trying to be dismissive of it. I read a lot of it. It was just like, okay, like, what's the why am I reading this? You know, like, what's the ultimate point of this? And I think Enos would say, I don't know, there isn't any really. He
would say it's fun. And that's my take on it. So you just did not have fun while reading this. What is your asterisk?
Oh, my asterisk is, like, I can tell it's well written, and it's, like, okay. I chuckled at a few parts, you know, like, I had a little bit of fun, but I don't know if I had enough fun for me to be like, yeah, thumbs up, I totally dug this,
okay.
this comic.
Well, we realize where your line is, I think. You are not a Garth Ennis fan.
Can we talk about the Vigilante Squad for a second, though?
Well, before that, okay. Really quickly, I do want to talk about that. I was wondering if you thought about Preacher while you were reading this, because I think...
I was going to tell you, I think it was good that you had me watch Preacher before this.
Yeah.
Just because I think I would have thought maybe differently of Enos's, like, worldview, if that makes sense. Because there's something inherent about... And I know you have to also take the entirety of superheroes into consideration when you're talking about this, but like there is something inherently unsettling about within this like very idealized world of Marvel and superheroes that there's a guy who's just decided that the law doesn't work adequately for him. He's going to take the law and justice into his own hands and he's just going to like kill everyone who's bad.
Yes.
I think if there's something again cathartic about watching someone cut through all the red tape and just be like, nah, fuck him, he's bad. But there's also something really disturbing about it, and I don't mean that in like a gun violence sense. I mean that in like an I'm above the law sort of sense.
Yeah,
if that makes
sense. This book ends with Punisher lighting Ma Nucci's house on fire while she explains to him why he's a serial killer and why he's an insane person.
Yeah.
And I don't think you're supposed to think she's wrong just because she's the bad guy. I think Enos agrees with that.
Mm-hmm. I do too. And I don't know if I would have, because the the ending of the Ma
Nucci... let's talk about the vigilante. Oh, so I'm sorry.
I was gonna say the ending of the Ma Nucci Punisher thing ends with a sequence that is wonderful. Like, I giggle.
I feel the way you feel about that sequence about the whole book. And I'm not sure why we feel differently about the rest of the book. I think that's where I'm not saying you should. I'm not saying you're wrong. Of course I'm not saying that. But
it might be doing it over and over again for 12 issues, if that makes sense.
Okay, that's fair. I think that is a complaint people make about Garth Ennis, is that eventually the dick and fart jokes get a little tiresome, and I think that's fair.
This is before we get to the Vigilante Squad, within 1 week, I saw two really interesting twists on the You're Not So Different, You and I speeches. One of them was in HBO's Barry, which everyone should go watch because it's amazing. But the other one was in this one, and I appreciated that Ma Nucci gave the villainous, you know, we're not so different, you and I speech, and it fucking lands. Like, it's
it works very well. Yeah. I agree. I think what I like in general about Enos the best is that it doesn't seem like... So one of my favorite books ever is Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Mm-hmm.
And as that book goes on, it eventually starts becoming all jokes and no character development in any kind of real way.
Mm-hmm.
The first book doesn't feel that way. The second book doesn't feel that way. It starts to as they go on. And I think when you have a certain kind of sense of humor, it's very, very difficult to insert really memorable character moments into something. And there's beautiful character moments in this. The stakeouts that Soap and Molly have they feel really nice.
It made me wonder what an entire, like a shorter, but an entire run told completely from their point of view would be. Like,
right.
It would be
right.
Kind of interesting to just see two law enforcement officials unsure of how to deal with this, you know?
Right. Enos's two biggest series, Preacher and a book called The Boys, are both very, very heavily characterized by the sense of humor, and both of them end in such a dramatically complicated character way that brings to a head all of the differences between all these characters that they're stunning. It feels the way the finales of Garth Ennis's stuff feel, the way that the Christmas special of the British Office felt to me. Meaning that, like, yes, we've made a lot of really uncomfortable, stupid jokes this whole time, and there's this gut punch of a real relationship conversation that happens at the end of it that, like, lays you out. And I don't think this book reaches that, because I don't think it has time to, but I think Enos is absolutely very, very capable of writing extremely complex and beautiful character moments. Especially about tough guys, which is hard to do because he essentially writes all about alpha males.
Interesting.
So let's talk about the Vigilante Squad.
Okay, so part of the narrative is about this squad of copycat vigilantes who sort of start to surface. One of them is this guy who, I forget their names. One of them is a guy who who despises kind of like institutional corporate crime.
That's Mr. Payback.
Mr. Payback. So he's killing like corrupt CEOs and stuff. And
he wears like a wife beater and blue jeans. There's a better word for a wife beater. I hate that word. I always forget what
the tank top,
yeah,
right?
He's wearing he's very clearly like, you know, a socialist, like freedom fighter type. Like that's what he wants to be.
There is one who is basically, who's like straight up a racist. I mean,
yes,
that's elite.
Yes. Who is very, very concerned about his upper class Manhattan community being encroached upon by minorities, drug dealers, and, basically anything that he doesn't, see to be, you know, in equal to his neighborhood.
And one of them, like, I mean, the very first scene we see of him is like, you know, like a car with black dudes pulling into his neighborhood. Are they dealing drugs or are they just there?
So it's not all black people. It is a kind of 80s diverse gang. there's two black people. I recognize that race plays a role in this as well. I'm not dismissing what you're saying.
No.
Black people, one white person, I think a Hispanic person. They are dealing drugs, although it's unclear how he knows that. And in fact, it's suggested that he probably would have shot him even if he didn't know that for sure.
Yeah, and his catchphrase is, "This is a nice neighborhood."
Yes.
And then he just murders people.
He also kills an old lady's dog because it's peeing on the sidewalk.
Yeah.
And drops a grenade into a hot dog vendor's truck because he's too close to his neighborhood.
Right. And then we get like a sociopath priest who gets like cartoonishly villainous people confessing to him, and yes, he can't control his rage and he just keeps killing people.
Killing them with an axe. That is Hector Redondo, also calling himself the Holy.
Yeah.
So I like this. I know Bobby doesn't. I'm going to explain why I like it. And then I also am not dismissing what you have to say about it, because I think you're definitely right on about what I think you're going to say.
And my thing is, there are two people who are acting incredibly inappropriately. And there's one person who is acting exactly as appropriately as the Punisher.
Mr. Payback has this speech about how he is, all of these people in this courtroom right before he starts shooting them have just done horrible things. And they full on basically admit, yes, but it's money. This is our job. And he shoots them all. And I think the weakness in that, and I think you're right about it, is that it's very clear that Garth Ennis's politics lay with Mr. Payback, as do most of the people reading this book. Because at the end, when the Punisher inevitably rejects them all and kills them, because of course that's what he's going to do, the only reason he rejects Mr. Payback is because there has been collateral damage. He keeps accidentally shooting people through, you know, walls and stuff like that.
Which, unless I'm not reading carefully, we find out about at that moment, right?
Yes, you're right. You're right. Now, I do agree that that is a little bit of a cop-out. However, I find it interesting in a positive way that Punisher, who of course you have a character like Punisher, everybody who writes that is going to try to take a political bent on that character. I think Ennis is trying very, very hard to show us like as many different kinds of political morality as you can think of, and show that Punisher is not a political entity. He exists outside of all of those. And it's not necessarily a good thing or bad thing. He just has no interest in that. So we have this kind of liberal anti-corporate morality. We have this very, very conservative social morality. And then, of course, we have this wrath of God religious morality. And he looks at all three of them as if they're equally insane. I get what you're saying.
But the way you're explaining it, it makes me sound like I'm going to just lay down like a heavy partisan line. But what it ends up making it sound like is that Punisher is only concerned with street level crime. And when it comes to institutional crime, which is debatably more, if not, I mean, as much, if not more harmful than, you know, what he's fighting with, like, cartoonishly mafioso families.
Which is interesting because Ennis has written other Punisher comics that deal very heavily with serious political issues. There's a really, really great six-issue run of Punisher Max, which is this really, really grounded series that has no... It exists outside of superheroes. It's basically an alternate reality Punisher.
I've heard about it.
It's really good. It's different than this. But he has a six-issue series where he deals with sex slavery, and it deals with it in a very real way. And that's a huge sociopolitical issue, right? So it's... I agree. It's a little bit of a misstep.
It's not just sociopolitical. It's like quite literally institutional, borderline legal criminality that Punisher has no interest in. He's just like, well, if people are getting sucked into, you know, people as part of institutions are committing crime or committing injustices, I don't care. It's only the mafia. That's what it feels like it ends on. Yes. I'm like,
I agree. I think that's the biggest difficulty with Punisher in general. I really, really do like the Netflix series, and there's one thing I absolutely hate about it, which is there are two characters, and I didn't notice how bad the first one was until I got to the second one. The first character we meet is this in the support group, who is this very, very cartoonish NRA conspiracy theory anti-Obama guy who we're obviously supposed to roll our eyes at. He's played by the sergeant from The Wire, the really big guy. I forget his name. Jay something.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, you know who I'm talking about. It doesn't matter.
Do you watch The Affair?
No, I don't.
Oh, okay.
Sorry.
I think he plays McNulty's father-in-law in The Affair, which is pretty funny.
Oh, weird. Yeah. Okay.
Anyway, I'll shut up.
No, that's okay. And then, but then later we get this very, very craven political gun control person who's also like very, very silly and selfish and kind of a hack and like a horrible person. And like, well, then what the hell are you saying one way or the other? Like, say something, you know? And that series particularly, I mean, it's about veterans. And yeah. I am fine with veterans having complicated views on guns. I fully understand that, and I don't even dismiss it. I am a pacifist, but I'm a pacifist who does recognize I live in a country that would not exist the way it does if the military had not existed the way it does for centuries. So I have complicated feelings about it. But yeah, I felt the same way about that I think you sound like you're feeling about this, which is a little bit of like, well, come on, then, like, are you saying anything?
Yeah, I think that's fair. I don't really think I hated this, though.
I don't think you did. I could tell by the way we've talked about it before. I think this... I mean, would you say this is the least you've liked something that I've picked, though?
Yeah, I would say so. I don't know.
That's fair.
I don't know. It's because I've definitely thought about it. Like, for example, I gave this a lot more thought than I gave Sleeper, but...
Yeah.
I probably like Sleeper more.
Okay. I think there is more thought to be had about this. I think this book does do interesting things. I just, there's something about me that is very drawn to Garth Ennis' style. And I mean, I've apologized for it so many times on the show. I mean, I keep over-explaining why I like it. I know that there's something weird about me liking it, but I like it anyway. I don't know. It's hard to explain his stuff. Well, I ran out of steam there.
Should I read his?
Is there anything else
I read
you would
his
like?
Max comic?
I don't know. I mean, I would have said before. So here's the thing. Before this, I would have said no, and I would have said no because I would have thought you would have been very turned off by the Punisher existing in a world where real political concerns exist, because I think then that ideologically celebrates the Punisher as a solution to those things. However. It sounds like you disliked this because that wasn't in there.
Huh.
So,
interesting.
So, you see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So I'm not sure. I love Punisher Max, too. It's very different than this. I mean, it's basically a whole series of just the way the Punisher talks in this. Like Punisher has no sense of humor in these books, right? Those comics exist in a world similar to that. They're very, very good.
I'm going to check them out.
Yeah. Okay. Eventually, not soon, but eventually I'm going to pick Punisher, the TV show, for this. However, there's two episodes that I would want you to watch if we pick that, so we're going to take a little while before we do that. Because
I legit very much want to watch the Punisher TV show.
Yeah. The really beautiful thing that the show does, and this is why I want you to watch two episodes, is it gives Frank a friend, and it takes like four episodes for them to become friends. Like it's a Punisher bromance season, which is brilliant. And you get to see what that friend is like. Punisher in the 70s and 80s, people kind of forget this because everyone likes their comics so realistic these days. Punisher was a superhero. So he had like a high-tech battle van and a man in the van basically called Micro. And the TV show kind of Netflix Marvel's Micro. It makes him into a more believable real person. And it's very, very fun to see someone with the exact opposite set of skills as Frank working with him, in terms of like male camaraderie. It's well done.
I also want to bring up, I think I was thinking about the wrong person from The Wire.
Oh, that's okay. I forgive you. All I can say to describe this guy is that he's very overweight, and that's like a shitty thing to say about a person.
I know who you're talking about, and I was talking about Rawls, so.
Oh yeah, not Rawls. Yeah. The like really gross, weird. Yeah. Like,
the guy
he's
who gets
kind of an asshole.
He gets introduced by going like, "This is for you, McNulty," with like two middle fingers, right? That guy.
Yeah.
I know.
Yeah. All right. So
did you know Rawls plays McNulty's father-in-law in
Oh my god.
In The Affair.
So Bobby, what are you picking for next time?
All right. What episode is this?
I believe this is 15.
15 episodes is how long it took for me to like make you spend money on a thing. So I'm sorry.
I spent money on Vision.
Did you? I thought you had a Marvel Unlimited thingy.
Oh no, I don't anymore, but that's okay.
Oh, well, okay. Well then it was 14 episodes.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm gonna make you spend $3 on an iPhone app.
Okay,
this is my next one. So I have made very clear that the iPhone app Altos Adventure has really been a big part of my life.
Oh, and God, so I've been dreading this day for months.
I told
Bobby.
You a couple of weeks ago that I was going to pick an iPhone app as one of my picks eventually, and you said very snarkily, "I wonder what that's going to be," meaning that you believed it was going to be Altos Adventure or Altos Odyssey, and I had been waiting for this moment when I could tell you, no, it's not going to be Altos Adventure or Altos Odyssey.
Oh, God. Okay, thank God.
It is an app called Florence.
Okay.
It is by a couple of the, I think it's by one of the lead designers of Monument Valley, which is a very popular mobile
game. I've heard of
it. Florence, I hesitate to call it a game. It's more of an interactive story. It's about a young woman named Florence who kind of doesn't know where she wants to go in life or what she wants to be. And then she meets a young cellist named Krish, and it's kind of about their relationship and the effect it has on both of their lives. And
I dozed off for a second there. Were you saying something?
Anyway, I really like this this app, this experience, this whatever it is. So yeah, it's like $3. It'll take you about a half hour to get through it, but
okay,
we're gonna do that.
Something I forgot to ask you earlier. Is Vision's name Vision Vision? You kept calling them the Visions, and the book keeps doing that too.
No. He would just be Vision, right? But
then
they
why
don't...
are they called the Visions? Is her name Virginia Vision?
But
and
like what else
Vin
would
Vision
you...
and Viv
I think
Vision?
It's more of a comment of like the even when we don't have a clean even when people don't fit a like the mold for naming conventions that we have. In modern American society, we still always take like a very patriarchal approach to it. And so when we don't have a last name, we look to the man of the family and we just identify everyone else in the family by the man in the family.
So what did they write when they signed for the house?
Vision of the Avengers.
That's probably not a legally binding document then.
He saved the world 37 times.
I think they should do a new book just specifically dealing with the legality of his name.
Okay. I mean, if Tom King wrote it, I'm sure it'd be fucking amazing, so I'm fine with that.
By the way, so was this canceled or did it just end on its own terms? Because it's 12 issues and it's a very self-contained story. Did he intend to write more?
I don't know. I'm assuming it got to the end on its own terms.
Okay.
There's a very clear smooth arc, you know. It reaches a climax and then it ends on a very kind of poignant note.
All right. Yeah, people, you should read Vision. You know, I think you should read Punisher, but Bobby's stupid and disagrees, so that's fine.
No, I mean, read Punisher. It's fine. Read Punisher. But that's not what we're talking about. I'm telling you to download Florence and do Florence.
The Florence and the Machine? The band?
I mean, you can listen to Florence and the Machine also. Well, don't do that while you're doing the app. The app has really... I'm just going to call it a game. The game has really good music, too, so...
I don't know.
You're already shitting on this, and I'm already heartbroken, because you're going to come back next week and be like, what the fuck was that, Bobby? And I'm going to be like, shut up, dude.
I'm emotionally punishing you for not liking my thing. I feel so rejected right now. Okay, sorry. I'm done being an ass. Was there anything else you wanted to say about it?
It's good. No.
Okay.
No, I just, it's sort of a new medium as far as, like, what we've talked about. So
I have not played a lot of kind of, you know, of the experimental app narrative, whatever things that are existing in, the modern age of gaming. So I'm interested. I'm looking forward to it. My pick for next time is something I've actually been thinking about for a while. And then I went through a real roller coaster of emotion last week when it was announced that Brooklyn Nine-Nine was canceled. And then everyone online lost their minds. And then 2 days later, it was announced that NBC had saved it. It has been switched to NBC. So I am picking Brooklyn Nine-Nine. This is definitely my favorite current comedy on the air. It was tied for a long time with New Girl, although that one is ending. And I am picking two episodes. Season 3, Episode 8 is called Ava. And season 4, episode 16, is called Moo Moo. For those of you who do not know, Brooklyn Nine-Nine is a very, very silly and woke comedy about police, which is a very strange sentence to say, but it's very good. The show has some of the most kind of effortless diversity I've ever seen. It feels a lot like Steven Universe or something like that in the way that it deals with those issues. They're just inherent to the story. And so I picked two episodes. One is kind of just a great ensemble piece that shows off all the characters really well in their different roles. And then the second one is kind of the closest that the show gets to a very special episode where it's dealing with some actual social issues that I think are interesting. And I think the episodes are both done well. I will say that while I don't think either of the ones I picked have any very, very over-the-top moments of this, Andre Brower's performance on that show is something really, really special. I would put him in the same category as Ron Swanson in terms of memorable characters. His character is fantastic, and it never stops being funny, and it allows for him to have a lot of versatility to how they use the character. So yeah,
from the Nine-Nine. From the handful of episodes I've seen, he really stands out.
He is a special presence on that show for sure. And I mean, I started the show just because I'm a huge Andy Samberg fan, mm-hmm. and Lonely Island in general, who are all kind of related to the project in a couple of different ways. So yeah,
I want to say this was a thing I should have mentioned at the beginning. Among the shows that were canceled, in the massacre last week was Last Man on Earth, a show I'm like several seasons behind on. I'm part of the problem. But Yorma Taccone tweeted at Will Forte and said something to the effect of like, oh man, I'm sorry, but let's go make MacGruber 2.
Yes.
And I
saw that.
I wanted that to be real so bad.
Last Man on Earth is really interesting. I want to watch more of it, and I'm bummed that I ended. It was very unique. From what I've seen, it's unlike any other show I'd ever seen on television. Very, very strange.
Yep.
Follow through on that concept. So, yeah, good stuff. All right, man. So, what did we learn this week?
We learned that I don't know. What did we learn? It's been one of those weeks, man.
Yeah, I just blanked too. I was going to say something also. I don't know. I didn't take notes
either.
Good episode, man.
If you like our podcast, like and follow us, subscribe on iTunes and be good to yourself and other people.
Be good to yourself and other people. Bobby's famous sign-off. All right, bye.
You're wrong with Ian and Bobby. You're wrong.